Dave, should we start with the questions or should I tell them the truth about Dave Crossland?
Do what you want. I don't care.
I think you do care. I think you do care. Hey, what's up, guys? Welcome back to Drugs and Stuff with Dave Crossland. I'm Scott McNally. Our programming is brought to you by GetAzoth.com. Dave, I bet your package hasn't made it yet, but it's on its way.
It's not here.
All right. Well, Azoth is a fantastic nootropic product. I've been using it for at least a couple of years now. Guys, you can check them out down in the description. We're also brought to you by TrueNutrition.com. You could use our code ADVICES for some additional savings. Well, listen. We have, I'm not going to call it drugs in the news. Hell yeah, we'll call it. Guys, we've got a drugs in the news. This is, it's a study that we found. Actually, Victoria discovered the study. The title of it is, let's see here, pull it up. Here's the cover. It says, is competitive bodybuilding pathological? It's a survey of 984 male strength athletes. Now, some of these people were competitors, some of them were not. And it says, some writers have characterized competitive bodybuilding as bizarre or narcissistic, but few empirical studies have assessed whether the sport is actually associated with elevated levels of pathology. Comparing 96 competitive bodybuilders with 888 recreational strength trainers, we found that competitors were much more likely to have used anabolic androgenic steroids and other appearance-enhancing and performance-enhancing drugs. However, on a wide range of other measures, including demographic features including attitude toward body image, use of alcohol, cigarettes, and classically illicit drugs, history of psychiatric diagnosis by a professional, and history of childhood physical or sexual abuse, competitors did not exhibit greater psychopathology than their recreational counterparts. Aside from their heavy use of potentially hazardous drugs, competitive bodybuilders do not appear to be any different than recreational strength trainers on a wide range of characteristics. What do you think of that?
I think that the driving influence between getting into training and trying to change the body image are probably quite universal. You will get one thing that study does say, which I found quite interesting, was that the competitive bodybuilders were much more likely to be open with medical professionals, and the recreational bodybuilders or the recreational users or whatever were much less likely to be open with medical professionals about their drug use.
Yeah.
That bears out with what I see. I mean, recreational is a much bigger group. And I know that study doesn't specify all users. It's competitive bodybuilders against non-competitive weight trainers, so to speak. But obviously steroids are a part of that. And what I find is that, generally speaking, though competitive users may have a greater drug use, they are actually much more health conscious.
I can see that.
And engage with professional, and engage with medical staff much better. Whereas recreational users or casual users, or however you want to term it, tend to have a much more flippant attitude to drug use.
Yeah.
They are generally much less educated on the harms of drugs, and so therefore have much less preventive measures in place and are much more mistrusting of medical professionals.
Yeah.
And basically what you tend to find is that competitive guys have either done a lot of research themselves and learn, or they're under a coach that knows what they're talking about.
Mm.
And as a result, health concerns and drug management protocols are in place.
Yeah, sure. I can see that.
Recreational or casual users tend to be driven by what their mate Jim does. And a typical question I get loads is, what do you think about taking this and this? My mate done it and he looks fucking massive.
Yeah.
You know, and though that is very stereotypical and probably a little bit simplified, it is very typical of the sort of communication you get with casual users. And as a result of that, generally, because they're not dedicated, because they're not driving towards a priority goal like competitive bodybuilders are.
Yeah.
Diet can quite often be wayward. Alcohol consumption can be a lot higher. Recreational drug use can be a lot higher because it is a general casual approach.
Hmm.
But the physical drivers of insecurity and poor body image do seem to be relatively standard across the board.
That's what this says, which, you know, I think a lot of people, you know, they mention the word narcissistic. And, they, you know, a lot of people look at competitive bodybuilders and they're like, oh, they're just so tied up in self-image and they're just, you know, so, you know, obsessed with their image. But this itself, it says, let's see, respondents in both the competitive and recreational groups reported high levels of concern with body image, with about 40% responding that they were preoccupied with the imagined deficit or a slight physical abnormality. 20% responding to this caused distress or impairment in areas of life. However, we found there no significant difference between the competitive and recreational groups on these measures, whereas we're thought of as being so insecure as competitors a lot of times.
But yeah, but that's not saying that competitors are insecure and competitors aren't narcissistic. What it's saying is you're just the same as non-competitors.
Sure, sure. I just feel that a lot of times, and I almost feel like look at our channel, you know, we used to just do audio podcasts, right? And I feel like we reached the hardcore demographic where the majority of the people who sought us out on advicesradio.com and, you know, through the podcast apps, they were looking for hardcore bodybuilding. Now on YouTube, we're reaching a much broader variety of people. And there are some people that look at us from that wider. There's people who might like, they might be following Steve Cook or somebody who is like, you know, a men's physique guy, and that they, you know, they're just as obsessed as we are as, you know, competitive bodybuilders, yet they point the finger that we're the ones that have this, this deficit, you know?
I mean, this current situation has definitely exposed just how vulnerable in general the community is.
Yeah.
And I've had quite a few people come forward with very problematic relationships with their drug use.
Yeah.
And having no good reason to continue that drug use at the moment because they don't have access to a gym or the whatever, you know, but basically the environment is restricted what they can do. So they're then having to consider reducing that drug use and they're really struggling with it. Because they link their confidence and their personality to their shape and size, which they link to their drug use, and therefore if drugs goes, that goes, and then I no longer exist. But that is definitely not exclusive to competitors. It is a broad spectrum problem throughout the industry where people use.
Sure.
And even so within the fitness industry in general, there's plenty of people I know having meltdowns because they can't train how they used to.
Yeah.
And not involving any drug use, just the fact that they feel that, you know, their quality of an individual is slipping away because they don't have access to a gym or they don't have access to the normal exercise routine.
Yeah.
So, no, I mean, I think you may find that competitors, I think you might find a slightly different picture if you looked at the response to removing the ability to train and compete and be who they are.
Hmm.
So what I mean by that is I think if at the moment that study looks at a questionnaire based on how people view themselves and their body image and how important it is to them.
Right.
But I think if that study looked at, right, how would you cope if you couldn't compete and you couldn't train and you couldn't do any of these things anymore?
Hmm.
I think you'd probably find competitive bodybuilders would score lower in that field,
yeah,
over non-competitive bodybuilders. But
yeah.
But in general, the drivers for most people are the similar. What is quite interesting about that as well is it mentions sexual abuse and such triggers.
Mm-hmm.
And proportionally, they're quite high numbers. I mean, they're talking 4% and 10%, I think, was the other one.
Really? Really? Huh.
Have you ever looked at the study? Let's see if I can get it up. But it mentions, you were reading it out a minute ago, it mentions about hang on, problems as drivers towards.
Yeah, that was in the intro.
Yeah. Yeah, so we found the prevalence of reported childhood physical abuse, which is effectively 9 to 10%, or sexual abuse, which was at 4.2% or 4.5%. So they're quite, I would have said they're quite substantial numbers. They're 10% of people involved in lifting, rounded it up to the nearest whole figure, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Have a history of physical abuse towards them.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know what the normal numbers are, but I mean, that 10% does sound high.
Yeah, I didn't realize that physical abuse was such a, it's an obvious one, I suppose, when you think about it, but I didn't realize it was such a high driver. I would be interested to see if that number carried out across a larger control group.
Yeah, I mean, I know that, yeah, I could see that. I could see it for sure. And as far as things related to sexuality goes, what did this say? It said, you know, a lot of times we hear, what's one of the other stereotypes? Oh, bodybuilding is gay. Putting on a banana hammock, getting on stage, getting oiled up, that's so gay. You hear that all the time. Yet, looking at this study, it says competitors also showed no significant difference from recreational trainers on a level of education, marital status. Where was this? None of the competitors reported a homosexual or bisexual orientation as compared to 4.4% of the recreationals. So isn't that 4.4% that's actually pointing the finger at the competitors? I wonder.
I think one of the problems is that when you get down to brass tacks about competitive bodybuilding, it is effectively a beauty show.
Sure, sure. It is.
You are sat there in your skimpies.
Yeah.
And you are covered in oil.
Beauty, it's a physical. I don't know if I would argue that, Dave. I don't know if I'd say beauty because it's, you know, look at, you mentioned.
It's a physical beauty rather than a facial beauty, but it's still a beauty contest. You're still looking at the most pleasing and balanced physique set about by a set of criteria, yeah?
Sure, sure. I don't know if I'd call Branch Warren pretty, though.
No, I wouldn't call Branch Warren pretty.
But he is fucking sick in a way that I like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, there is an element of that beauty pageant about it. Right down to the spangly trunks and the sort of showmanship element of it all. You know, there is just a bit of an element there.
Sure, sure.
But I don't see that as a driver towards or as an attraction to someone that's homosexual, really.
Yeah.
But I see the sport being attracted to someone who's homosexual in the same way as Miss World is attractive to somebody who's heterosexual.
Yeah, sure.
You know, as a heterosexual male, it's pleasurable to look at good-looking women.
Absolutely.
And I don't mean just facially, I mean physically as well.
Yeah.
So in the same way, as a gay male, I would assume if that's your taste, obviously it's got to fit that that's your taste, but I would assume it would be attractive to look at men that physically look well.
Yeah.
Maybe the open classes and the bodybuilding extent of physiques is probably a more niche element of sexual taste.
Sure.
But definitely the men's physique and the board shorts and the lesser end of physique development would be probably more broad spectrum attractive to a lot of people.
Yeah. So it's interesting because, you know, this whole thing was talking about how, you know, that maybe there aren't as many differences between competitors and non-competitors as once thought, that people looked at us as being, they used the term freak show, you know, they used the, you know, the ideas that we're being weird and outside, that it, and it is, you know, you can see it, like I said, you can see it in the response from the general public. I mean, we've had posts that we've boosted that have been viewed by thousands and thousands of people. And I'll tell you what, we've gotten some really bizarre comments from people who are outside of our world, who are like, oh my God, they look at Jordan Peters and they're like, holy shit, they've done stuff like, you know, people will then comment to get their friends in on it, you know, comment their friends' names and, you know, tag them in the comments and all that. And then people just have just a fit, you know, looking at like, oh, that's so disgusting. It challenges people, I guess. But in the reality of it, they said the pathology is not going to be really that different than anybody else.
No, I don't think it is. I mean, I think anyone that starts to strive to change the physiques has the basic underlying same drivers.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, a dissatisfaction with how they appear.
Yeah.
And that will vary across. In the same way you've got people with makeup, you've got people with cosmetic surgery.
Sure.
You know, they are all... and obviously, choosing to use drugs is a more extreme step.
Yeah.
But I don't see the choice between a non-competitive and a competitive bodybuilder being any less of a decision, to be quite honest. And I say, if anything, I think competitive bodybuilders take their drug taking much more seriously.
Yeah.
Whereas non-competitive can tend to be a little bit too casual about it.
Yeah. All right. Well, listen, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we've got some questions. We've got some questions from before. We've got some questions on the live feed. And we also have a topic I want to get to because we're in the midst of a movie star, basically. We'll talk about that when we get back. Hey, what's going on, guys? Scott here. I'm going to jump in with a brief shout out to our great sponsors. First of all, thank you so much, Azoth, for advertising with us here at Advices Radio. Oh, what's that, guys? You said you don't know what a nootropic is? Oh, well, let me tell you. Sorry, I just wanted to say that. But seriously, guys, if you aren't familiar with nootropics, which I'd be surprised if you're not, considering that you listen to Advices Radio, I feel like we've got some pretty smart listeners here. I'm going to read you a definition. Nootropics are drugs, supplements, or other substances that may improve cognitive function, particularly executive function like memory, creativity, or motivation. And I'll tell you what, Azoth does all of those things for me. This is a fantastic blend, and I get a lot out of it. You know, I use it when I get more stuff done at work. I also use it just for other things. Like, it's great for training. If you want to get like that leg day in and get that super driven focus, take it about like, we'll say 40 minutes before you train and tell me you don't experience a difference. I take it when I go on a long drive. I just get relaxed. I sit back and I'm just kind of plugged in and more focused on what I'm doing, getting more out of the experience than I would have otherwise. So check it out. And plus, if you do, you can support our programming. So it's like a win-win. You get to get more stuff done in life and you get to support Advices Radio. So I've got links in all of our descriptions, whether you're at YouTube or at the website, advicesradio.com. There's even a link to get some for free. If you haven't tried it before, Brady has a rebate. So check it out and also check out their other products, Total Focus and Pure Energy. Both of those feature the new ingredient, Zynamite. All right, guys, I'm almost finished, but I also want to shout out our other sponsor, TrueNutrition.com. I'm going to tell you a little fact here. This is something I didn't know. Skip knew this. I didn't know this. So if you order 5 pounds of protein from True Nutrition, here's what they do. First of all, they measure out 5 pounds of protein. And after that, they add the additional flavorings in. So what you end up getting is going to be like a 6 pound bag. If you were to go into the store and buy 5 pounds of protein from, you know, whatever it is, GNC, for instance, you get 5 pounds. It's actually going to be more like 4 pounds of protein plus the additives. So you're already getting a really good deal because True Nutrition charges what's just about wholesale rates. And on top of that, you're getting extra protein. So you can't beat that. They're high quality. Everything's third-party tested. Dante Trudell is a dude that if he told me, like, hey, go lay down on those railroad tracks, I promise you won't get hit, I would believe that. And I think a lot of us in bodybuilding would. And there's a reason for that, because he's a stand-up dude. Anyway, I don't know how I got to that, but somehow I did. Anyway, guys, check out TrueNutrition.com. They are a fantastic company. I've believed in them since long before they sponsored us here at Advices Radio. Use our code ADVICES. That'll get you a discount, and it will support our programming. Guys, I hope everybody's doing well. Thank you for listening to my ads.
I hope you had some fun. I know I did. Let's get back to the show.
Hey, what's up, guys? Welcome back to Drugs and Stuff with Dave Crossland. Our programming is brought to you by GetAzoff.com and TrueNutrition.com. You can use our code ADVICES for some additional savings. Dave, should we start with the questions or should I tell them the truth about Dave Crossland?
Do what you want. I don't care.
I think you do care. This is,
you've been threatening this for 2 weeks now.
This is, I got something here. This is goes out to a good friend of mine. Her name is Mrs. Crossland. And she said that I was quickly becoming her favorite after she saw me post that I knew about this. Tell me if you guys can recognize somebody that's in this commercial ad here. Hold on.
So is it now playing?
It's playing.
Rensip Squad! We have long days ahead of us.
Which one is this?
A fair few miles to cover. You're searching for people to surprise and cheer up. Do I have your comfort commitment? Good.
All right, I'm going to turn the volume down so I can commentate here. So I see Dave Crossland wearing these green pants and suspenders and a yellow shirt. How do they find a shirt? Your shirt's different.
Whoa. What are suspenders?
You've got green suspenders on.
No, they're not. That's technically what you'd probably call a bib and a brace, or it's dungarees.
And you're hugging stuff. What's up with this? What am I looking at here?
Suspenders are a sexy item worn by women to hold up their stockings.
What did I just look at there? What did I see?
I, over the years, I've done a little bit of TV ad work. I did some work for Adidas years ago. That was quite funny. I was recruited by Adidas for them to take pictures of my arse.
What?
Basically, I was to bend over into the back of a van. I was playing a roadie. Adidas did a series of adverts where they followed somebody. It was a little short film about somebody making a success of their life. So this was about a guy making a success as a musician. And all they did was just place Adidas logos in clothing and stuff in the little short film. So it wasn't a typical straight advert. It was a little short film. Mm. Everybody was wearing Adidas sneakers or trainers, whatever you want to call them. Everyone was wearing Adidas branded stuff.
I like the way you say Adidas. I bent in the back.
Well, that's the American way of saying it, isn't it?
Adidas.
But even Jeff Goldblum says it's actually Adidas.
Adidas.
Anyway, I had to bend over into the back of a van, and they had a very long, and I'm not exaggerating, 15-20 minute conversation, should I say, about how much ass crack showing off the top of my shorts represented the Adidas brand.
Oh my God.
It was insane. Anyway, the Lemsip Squad was a project brought up by a marketing company that was Lemsip's cold flu over-the-counter medicine.
Okay.
And they put on this idea that we were going to basically do a spoof of the A-Team.
Yeah.
And we were going to run around the country in a green and yellow van, which were the colors of Lemsip, which is why everything's green and yellow.
Okay.
And we were going to deliver Lemsip hugs. And a Lemsip hug was a treat to somebody who had done self-attacks. So that was the prequel ad. That was the little promo ad.
Yeah.
That was sent out. And it was going to be a viral thing. It was going to be internet only. And then we filmed. The first one was we collected a guy and his family. And this guy used to run a motorbike workshop for local kids.
Yeah.
That were troubled kids. He did it all for free. And we took them to Winter Wonderland. And then we did another one where we collected this woman who had given up on a music career to care for somebody. So we took her to a recording studio and she was allowed to record a song.
Yeah.
And so this was it. And so what you did was you nominated your friends and then we turned up like a bunch of pillocks in this van.
Oh, my gosh.
And delivered the surprise. It was all quite staged to a degree.
I like the part where you get stuck in the tunnel.
That's, yeah.
And then you're running around in the background with that tunnel on your head. That's pretty good. I got something else here for us, actually. So that's just one, guys. I've got another special for you here. There's a little company. They're called Readly. And Dave has a small part in this one. Why weren't you the man sitting on the toilet? Because I feel like that would have been funny to have Dave Crossland sitting on the toilet. You're only at the very end, guys. You got to wait for it for this one. By the way, it's a good thing we can't monetize our videos because we're playing all these. I mean, it's free advertisement for them. Who knows? We might be helping. Oh, look at that. Who's that? Who's that? Now, did you have a wig on for this one? Because you're.
Yeah.
So you had a wig on.
I had to go. The day before, I had to go for a wig fitting.
Yeah.
In this wig shop in London with the most camp guy you've ever met in your life. And okay. He was loving every minute of fitting me out for a wig.
That's funny, man.
And then obviously they shaved a line in it, but yeah, that was what a bad job that actually was. A 2-day job that was quite good.
Nah, I like this. This is great.
The best one, and it actually got banned, and it's been taken off YouTube.
Yeah,
we have a kitchen towel brand called Plenty.
Okay.
And the main guy in the ad campaign is a guy that dresses as a Spaniard, and he's called Juan Sheet.
Okay. Juan Sheet.
Yeah, as a piss of taking only needing one sheet to do a cleanup job.
Right.
Well, he has a very exaggerated Spanish accent in the ads. That is actually how he really talks. That is his real voice.
Yeah.
And the ad we did was Tiny Dave, which was me, had a mucky helmet and he needed to do the one sheet to polish his helmet.
Okay.
Now, I'm not so sure if helmet has the same double meaning in the States as it does in the UK. But we had a lot of difficulty filming this scene and it was deliberately done very spoofy, very stupid.
Yeah.
So like I was stood on a little wooden platform with roller wheels and I was basically wheeled in from the side.
Okay.
Shot, so I came. Well, it kept sticking and jamming, so it was all jerky. And they left all that in deliberate.
Okay.
And I've got a mucky mark on the top of my helmet and I'm just stood there with Terminator glasses on looking a complete cock. And he's talking about he's going to polish my helmet. Well, honestly, it took hours of takes to get this because someone would fucking laugh every time we did it.
Oh, my gosh.
Anyway, they did it. They released it, and straight away it got banned.
Oh, man. We got to get a hold of that, guys. If anybody has that commercial or if they know where it's at, we got to find that one.
That was hilarious. That was a real fun job to work as well, actually. It was a good laugh, was that?
That sounds like it. All right, let's get to some listener questions here. We got a few of them that have been piling up. You guys are welcome to throw questions in too. Let's see here. We'll start with the live feed here. Ryan says, Dave, what are your thoughts on microdosing log in prep with carbs only being utilized peri-workout? So we're talking Humalog here, fast-acting insulin. Using it during a diet phase. Now, Dave, I know like prepping isn't your forte, you know, necessarily.
No.
But in general, though, I mean, I have seen you help people get in shape. I've got thoughts on this, but I want to hear yours too.
I've seen people prep incredibly well on insulin.
Yeah,
I have seen Cranwell. Used to use it and do particularly well on it. But I struggle to understand why you would need it.
Yeah.
You're in a deficit. You're generally in lower carbs. You're going to be getting nice and insulin sensitive. So what use would you use the insulin for? Yes, you're going to stay a bit fuller, but that's not something that's difficult to replicate in other ways. You know, really, you sort of got to accept you're going to be flat when you die, and it's a sort of the nature of what you're doing.
Absolutely.
So, I'm not saying it's a complete no-no, because I don't think it is, but I just don't understand the thought process of being why you would want to do it. I don't see it as being necessary, but I don't see it as being particularly counterproductive if done correctly either.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, you know, okay, so I'm looking at a picture of Ryan right now. I went over to his profile. You know, he's definitely got a good build on him. The dude's been obviously working out, especially through, looks like the, I mean, I can see upper body is solid, great shoulders, chest, arms. Looks like if this is current, when was this taken? So this is February 23rd. He was in like near contest shape, it looks like. The dude is ripped. You know, he's big and he's ripped. I don't know how tall he is, but I'd put him at, you know, a couple hundred pounds, we'll say, depending on how tall he is. If he's, we'll say, average height, we'll say 5'8 or something like that. Now, if I know, Dave, for you, average height is like 6'4, okay?
So, I just don't understand. 5'10, surely he's got to be near average height. 5'11, not 5'8.
In bodybuilding? 5'10 for bodybuilding, I think, is
short asses.
We are, yeah. 5'10 for bodybuilding is considered to be a tall guy. You better be 290 on stage. You know, but
you're right. I guess
the point I'm getting at is I'm with you. You know, do you need this to, first of all, I mean, yeah, being flat is going to be part of it. Now, but I mean, as nice of a physique as he has, he's not a mass monster. You know, you can fill out. You know, what's insulin going to do? It's going to help you to shuttle more nutrients into the muscle, you know, but you can do that just fine. If you eat a cup of rice, you know, and then you eat a cup of rice, you don't need the insulin to fill out, you know. Now, if you were trying to pull something tricky where you needed to make weight and then be ready the next morning, then maybe you could potentially make use of a low dose, but then you're getting into some real murky water there too. I would say avoid it, man, personally, because, you know, being in a high insulin state, you're doing the opposite of getting in shape. Then you're storing, you know, you're going to store just fine. Especially like you said, Dave, if you're dieting, you're going to be sensitive to carbs. And if you eat, you know, enough of them, you're going to do just fine with them. I don't think you need to add insulin on top of it personally.
The other thing is as well, and I don't think a lot of people realize this, even fast acting insulin, though it has a 90-minute window peak, it's actually active for upwards of 12 hours plus.
Is it 12? Wow.
I believe so. The last time I looked at it, if I remember, it's a long time ago since I looked at it. I went through a lot of it with my loss, but I'm sure it's about 12 hours before it's done. So you're going to get an accumulative effect throughout the day.
Okay. Yeah, I thought Humulin R maybe was longer, like 8 or 10 or something like that.
They're all slightly different. That's the thing. I can't remember exactly what the numbers are. But okay. I know at the time when I looked at it, I was quite surprised that actually what was regarded as a fast-acting drug was fast to peak, was quite long to dissipate in relevance. I mean, even if it's 6 hours.
Yeah.
Even at 6 hours, you're still going to have an accumulative effect as the day goes on.
I agree. So even if they don't quote us on the exact time, a fast acting insulin is going to be, if maybe not high for a long time, but it's going to be active for a long time. There's that for sure.
Yeah, but if you're taking, say, you're taking 2 IUs with every meal.
Yeah.
You're not going to have 2 IU active when you're at the end of the day. You're probably going to have near a 6 or 7 IU active. You know that, and a lot of people fail to compensate for that and realize that as the day goes on, the active levels of insulin in your body are going to increase because the previous doses are still there.
I could see that for sure. I can see that. All right, let's see. We've got a couple more here. Novadex and Arimidex are getting. Anaerobic for getting drier up to a contest. 15 weeks out from one show, 20 weeks from another. Doses, recommendations. I guess I'll say first, Dave, does Novadex have a place in contest prep and getting drier? For a man.
I would have said if you're going to bring ADEX, then I wouldn't bother with Novadex if you're running it just because, I mean, effectively what you're trying to do is crash your estrogen levels to a point where you drop all your water. I mean, that's the whole process of it. You want to lower your estrogen so low that it will reduce your water levels. It shouldn't be necessary.
Yeah.
If you diet and you are lean, it shouldn't be necessary. But if you've missed the boat and you're coming in a little bit on the chubby side, then yes, crashing your estrogen will help dry you out, make you look leaner, and therefore you will appear to be leaner than you really are. obviously the downside of that is you're going to get one hell of a fucking rebound afterwards. So you need to look into managing your rebound because they can actually be quite dangerous.
Yeah. Now, and he asked a similar question on one of the previous shows recently. The thing I think he was getting at too was, Novadex doesn't have a place. Like, you know, should you be using Novadex to control estrogen in a prep?
I don't think there's anything wrong with using Novadex. Well, you don't control estrogen with Novadex.
And that's what,
that's the bottom line.
Yeah.
You know, Novadex has no impact on estrogen levels. What Novadex does is block certain receptors and promote estrogen in other receptors. So Novadex isn't just it's an agonist as well as an antagonist. So though it blocks, for the point of view of gyno, it promotes estrogen in the liver.
Does it really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's why it's beneficial for cholesterol. It supports healthy cholesterol because it promotes estrogen in the liver. Whereas, obviously, ADEX just lowers estrogen full stop.
Yeah.
Lower estrogen, hold less water. Does Novadex as a place going into cycle? That would depend on the compounds you're running, how sensitive you are to E2, whether you're likely to get gyno, because there's no point. The other thing is, it can be beneficial when you're looking at coming out the other side, managing rebounds and things like that. So it has its place, yes. Is it essential? No.
Yeah.
I like using Novadex as a background drug and then running a lower level of AI, but then most of my cycling is geared towards growth.
Yeah.
And obviously, estrogen plays an important role in growth. When it comes to comp, though I wouldn't recommend crashing your E2 going on stage, it is going to present a much drier physique if you do. But you will suffer for it afterwards. There's no denying that.
Yeah, but if you look good, who cares, Dave?
But if you diet correctly, you're not having to do this shit because
Agreed.
You're going to be lean anyway. You can't hold water if you're not fat.
100%. Totally agree with that.
You know what I mean? And it's like, well, if you're holding water going on stage, then you're effectively, you're not lean enough.
Yeah. Yeah. Go on.
No, I was saying, but in saying all that, you know, water manipulation can rescue a physique that would otherwise look smooth and bloated.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember doing some of it with Jordan years ago. It was when he was competing at British qualifying level. And he just scraped into the last day finals for the top 10.
Okay.
And he was smooth. And we didn't give him any water. He was allowed an ice cube to suck on. And we loaded him with dry carbs. And he stepped on stage the next day, remarkably fuller and drier.
Really? Really?
And jumped up to six.
No kidding.
So, you know, it can rescue a physique, there's no doubt, but the only reason Jordan was holding water was because he pissed about with growth hormone too close to the show.
No.
And he just wasn't lean enough.
Yeah.
And if you're lean enough, you will struggle to water out.
Yes, sir.
You'll just struggle to do it.
Yeah. We had some kind of related stuff to this. Somebody was asking now about, so there's a big movement nowadays to stay away from AIs altogether. You know, there's a movement like kind of in the TRT community where people are saying that it's the AIs that are so bad for you and that you should let estrogen be, that if you aren't experiencing side effects, that there's no reason to, control estrogen. We've talked about this, Dave. I know, you know, we talked about it numerous times, so I didn't want to really dive back into it because I know that your take has been that you are a fan of not controlling estrogen for growth, you know, if that's an option. And then further, you've said what? That a good TRT plan, and I think this is worth hitting home again, a good TRT plan, you shouldn't really need to control estrogen, right?
No. I mean, I know a few people that run their estrogen higher and they run it quite reasonably with no real problems. And, There is a very, definitely a very valid discussion to be had about the negative impact of, say, running estrogen at 200 as opposed to running it at, say, 70, but running an AI to achieve that.
Yeah.
You know, the negative impact of AIs on cholesterol, the negative impact of AIs in other areas. So there is definitely a valid discussion and argument to have there. I honestly don't know, when it comes to the TRT basis, which is best long term. Yeah. And I think the only reason is because no one's really, on a broad spectrum, it's not being done long term. This is quite a recent trend over the last few years. And so we need time to see if this is going to yield problems further down the line.
True.
But there's probably less negatives to run slightly elevated estrogen than there is to run continuous AIs, would be my initial thoughts on it.
Yeah, I feel like it probably depends on what your levels are, right? Like, you wouldn't want your estrogen to be through. Because I think he had pointed out, he said Stan Efferding says that if you don't feel side effects from high estrogen, you shouldn't touch it. And I don't know whether Stan was saying that that's the healthiest thing to do or that's the best thing to do for growth. But health, I have to imagine that just because you're not getting gyno, if your estrogen's through the roof, that's not necessarily going to be healthy for you either, you know?
No, I mean, there is going to be limits. And though how you feel needs to be considered, you need to take a more holistic approach and look at everything. So you need to look at bloods and counterbalance that against how you feel.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I mean, if you're pushing into the 250s, going near 300 on your estrogen levels, then I would suggest, I don't care how you feel, you need to look at some sort of management there.
Yeah.
But then again, how are you producing levels that high if your test level is being managed correctly? You shouldn't be able to, because if you were, you'd have had problems when your natural levels were present.
Sure, sure. That makes sense.
And some people just naturally run at higher levels. I mean, there is those anomalies in how people run.
Yeah.
You know, I've seen enough bloods now to know that some people naturally run on the lower side, some people naturally run on the higher side, and can be incredibly tolerant of high levels.
Yeah.
So there is definitely an argument for case by case. But I think any approach that minimizes unnecessary drug use is always going to be the better approach. And I think people can get a little bit upset, or have in the past been a little bit obsessed about, estrogen has to be low, estrogen has to be low, estrogen has to be low. And no, it doesn't.
Yeah.
And keeping some level of balance between your test and estrogen levels is very beneficial, as opposed to running one artificially low in relation to the other. But there becomes a point where, like with many things, you know, too much of a good thing and then things start to go wayward.
I agree.
But if you're running test levels...
Oh, go ahead.
Sorry. I was going to say, if you're running test levels in natural range, how are you getting extremely high estrogen levels? There's something not right there.
Yeah, I would have to think that there's two conversations here, conversation of cycling and a conversation of running a replacement dose.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so DHT compounds and finasteride. He was wondering if the finasteride will have any benefit, say, while using, we'll say, Proviron or Masteron or Winstrol.
None whatsoever.
Okay.
Next question.
Why?
Finasteride, however you want to say it.
Propecia for you guys.
Is a 5-alpha reductase inhibitor.
Okay.
5-AR is the compound that converts testosterone to DHT. If you minimize 5-AR, you don't get the conversion of testosterone to DHT, and that's how DHT is regulated by finasteride. If you have a DHT product, there is no conversion, and therefore 5-alpha reductase has no action, so reducing 5-AR is not going to impact the level of DHT from that drug.
Okay. So it will help with testosterone,
but won't help with DHTs.
Yeah. And I've heard now, I've had a question, and we may have talked about this a year or so ago. it will also block DECA from breaking down into dihydrobulbinon.
EQ breaks down into dihydrobulbinon.
Oh, excuse me. Into
dihydronandrolone.
Thank you. Yeah, my brain's apparently not firing on all cylinders. I need some more Azoth. Yeah.
EQ converts to DHB and DECA converts to DHN.
Okay. Yeah. So DHN.
Yeah, it's the same. Yeah, it's the same element. So finasteride would, and there is some influence of DHN on associating low libido or DECA dick with DECA use.
Okay.
Because DECA converts to DHN. DHN is much weaker than DHT, and as a result, does not sustain the same libido and erectile function. This is where you see people on very high dose DECA starting to get problems with erection that they then blame on DECA dick. But often that is also mismanagement of prolactin as well.
But part of that, so you're saying, and that makes sense, DHN would bind to the same receptor that DHT would.
Yeah, DHT.
Yes. Okay, that makes sense. So it would be competing for that same receptor. So DHT isn't able to do its job because it's now in basically conflict with the DHN that's at its same receptor.
And DHN is a much weaker signal. But more often than not, most people's problems with DECA are mismanagement of stuff like prolactin or estrogen and not anything to do with DHN.
Gotcha. All right. We did have one more question. It was about a push-pull split and setting that up. I mean, I feel like it's pretty straightforward. Let's see. Let's talk about that for a minute. How would we think this one out? Would you push-pull split? Would you do everything once a week? Would you do everything twice a week? Or would you rotate like push-pull legs, push, and then the next week start pull legs, push, pull?
That would depend on volume. Frequency and volume are basically two opposites. So higher the volume, lower the frequency. Lower the volume, higher the frequency. But if you're doing what is effectively a three-day split, then I would generally look at a three-on-one-off repeat. So it would be everything twice a week. But if you can only train 4 days, then do a push, pull, legs, push, and then next week do a pull, legs, push, pull, and then so you offset one by every week.
I mean
obviously the first thing to ascertain is how often can you train, and consistently how often can you train. There's no point saying, well, I can train 5 days some weeks but only 4 other weeks and then only 3 other weeks. Well, then it's probably best that you do a 3-day split, be that push ball legs or be that a different split, because then at least on your worst week you'll hit every body part you need to hit.
Yeah.
And then on the extra weeks we can get more in, then fine, you can double up on certain body parts. But I would look at what is your minimum ability to train and base your programming around that.
Yeah, that makes sense. That'd be a good place to start.
I mean, I
wonder though.
Yeah, well, I love high frequency. We've got a bit of a delay here today.
I think so.
I'm sorry.
No, that's okay, man. That's okay. I sensed that a minute ago. What about now? I guess another aspect would be recovery. If you're training 6 times a week, for me it was too much. You know, I switched to push pull legs, and that's exactly what I did 6 times a week. And then for me, I discovered, okay, I need to back off a little. I need a little more rest time. I went to 5 days. Eventually, I settled in at like about 4 days, worked good for me. And that was just from a recovery standpoint.
What sort of level of volume were you doing at that time?
I was doing pretty low. So each body part, I'd do 2 sets about, or excuse me, 4 sets total. So I might do chest, might be 2 sets of pec deck, followed by 2 sets of incline press. But they're like, you know, it took a lot of warm-ups, took a lot of feeders, and that's what I've been doing now. And they're very intense sets.
Yeah, I mean, it is a balance, like I said, between frequency and intensity as to what you can do. And obviously other factors play into that. How stressful is your life?
Yeah.
How good is your sleep? How hard is your work? either mentally or physically, because both will impact recovery.
Yeah.
You know, so there's loads of how good is your nutrition, how well can you stick to a diet, how frequently can you eat, and how consistent can you be in that. So there's loads of aspects that, I mean, I had a really simple rule of thumb when it came to recovery. I hammered it.
Yeah.
And then when I had a workout that wasn't so good, I'd pay notice. And if the next workout wasn't so good, I'd pay more notice. And if I got a third workout in a row that wasn't progressive, then I'd rest.
Yeah.
But if I had a bad workout, but the next one was great, then I would continue as is. And that was my basic rule of thumb. 3 to 4 workouts on the trot that were not up to par, I knew I had to take some time off or rest or increase my food or do something to improve my recovery.
Take more tren. More growth.
Yeah, always up the trend. Always.
Yes.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. Let's wrap it up here, man. Our connection is shite today.
It has gone very bad, hasn't it?
All right, guys. For another episode of Drugs and Stuff with Mr. David Stanley Crossland, check out crosslands.org.uk. And of course, check out our awesome sponsors. You can go to truenutrition.com, use our code ADVICES, and check out our new sponsor, getasoff.com. Guys, we'll see you soon.
Take care now.